Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello. And welcome to New Books in Media and Communications. I'm your host, Tal Zelmanovic. Earlier this week, I met with Professor Amit Pinchevsky to discuss his recent monograph, Transmitted Wounds, Media and the Mediation of Trauma. The book was published recently by Oxford University Press. We discussed, what does it mean to consider trauma in media from the perspective of technology and not from that of the subject of trauma, the clinician, or the witness? By bringing media theory to bear on trauma theory, Pinchevsky reveals the technical operations that inform the understanding of traumatic impact on bodies and minds. Under consideration is not the way trauma and traumatic memory figure in the media, be it through film, television, or photography, but rather media as partaking in the construction of the traumatic itself. Pinchevsky conducts his erudite exploration through a series of case studies. The radio broadcasts of the Eichmann trial, the videotaping of Holocaust testimonies, recent psychiatric debates about trauma through media following the 9/11 attacks, current controversy surrounding drone operators post-trauma, and digital platforms of algorithmic holographic witnessing and virtual reality exposure therapy for PTSD. Each of these cases makes a compelling argument about how media technology and logic shape the social life of trauma, both clinically and culturally. Transmitted Wounds takes us from mid-20th century to our current moment, moving us from an analog world of trauma to a digital ecosystem that promises to transcend trauma altogether. This temporal setup demands ethical considerations of past and current systems of memory, witnessing, and therapy, which Pinchevsky does exceptionally well. As I was preparing for our conversation, I was struck by the amount of questions, technical, moral, and ethical, that this book inspires, and I must confess that I am still considering some of the thought avenues Transmitted Wounds has opened up for me. So I suspect that this conversation will have a similar effect on you, and I thank you for downloading this episode and hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Hi, Amit. Thank you. Thank you for joining me today. Unlike most interviews that I conduct, we are actually seated in the same room on the campus of Tel Aviv University. So it's particularly nice to congratulate you in person on your wonderful book. So it is packed with thought-provoking arguments and grand narratives about modernity, trauma, and media. But it also takes time to intimately explore trauma, memories, and ideas about post-traumatic future. But before we get into some of this, why don't you introduce yourself? Maybe you could tell us a bit about your academic background and what brought you to this specific project.
Okay, sure. I did my undergrad and graduate studies here, actually, at Tel Aviv University in political science and humanities, and then did my PhD at McGill University in communications, and in a department that was really about the theory and history of media. And initially I was interested, and still to a certain extent, in philosophy of communication and ethics. But gradually I moved more and more into witnessing and media and witnessing. And this eventually led me to writing this book that was long time in the making. And in a way, summarizes my work in the last, 8 years or so, in trying to come up with some new ideas about the relation between media and trauma and traumatic memory.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a lot of things I want to ask you about, but I thought that maybe we can begin with your definition for the basic concepts of the book, which is media, trauma, and mediation.
All right, so it's not really my own definitions, mm-hmm. but I do try to develop them and tease them in a way. To the way that I want to work with them. So trauma, basically you can take it from a more clinical perspective, which speaks of a violent event, stressful mm-hmm. event that is so overwhelming that it fails to be registered as such. Mm-hmm. And then it comes to be relived and re-experienced belatedly. And from that, we have the pathology of trauma, but also different manifestation of traumatic memory. So how kind of a certain kind of memory that was not fully experienced or processed, if you want to take it in more kind of a technological sense, mm-hmm. Is repeated, reproduced in the present in a way that the present still try to kind of, come to grips with the past. So there's also an interesting issue of narrative, of memory, of history, all those questions having to do with trauma. Mm-hmm. Media, I deal with media technologies, and I have different sorts of media technologies here, both analog and digital. But the main question I am interested in is actually what I would propose as the transmission of trauma. And this is a kind of a term. Transmission is a term that crosses from both in psychology and psychiatry and in technology, mm-hmm. and to what extent we can actually talk about a transference and transmission of something that, properly speaking, is, unshareable. You cannot really share your pain. Mm-hmm. And how could you be wounded, mentally wounded, so to speak, via the media? So this is, mediation would here be the operation of media in doing precisely that, mm-hmm. in relating, transmitting, but also storing and processing those events mm-hmm. as traumatic events.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we'll talk a bit more about this later, but I just want to ask you another preliminary question, and that is that as I was reading the book, I thought that it really fits into many scholarly fields. So it can be media studies, it can be a book that belongs with the discussion of trauma, as you just said, or memory studies. Mm-hmm. And I could see it as making like a huge contribution to the field of science and technology studies as well. So I'm intrigued to hear where you think this book fits.
Well, it fits in all those places or all disciplines, but it's also a kind of a misfit, I think, mm-hmm. because my basic intuition was how would it be possible to bring media theory to bear on trauma theory? And trauma mm-hmm. theory is a big, vast field nowadays, which draws from the clinical field, but also has much to do with literary studies, with memory studies, mm-hmm. with media studies, communication studies, popular culture, and so forth, culture studies. So actually, I think it tries to speak to both, but also do a kind of a bridging effort here in trying to trace back and explore the fundamental conception of trauma and how this concept is associated and really informed by certain media logic and mm-hmm. technologies. So I would say it belongs to all those fields, mm-hmm. but it doesn't fit squarely in none of them.
Okay, actually, your answer kind of leads me to my next question, and is that I think the perspective of the book is quite unique because you make your argument through a number of case studies, so the radio broadcasts of the Eichmann trial, the videotaping of Holocaust testimonies, recent psychiatric debates about trauma through media following 9/11 events, current controversy surrounding drone operators post-trauma, and digital platforms of algorithmic holographic witnessing and virtual reality exposure therapy for PTSD. Mm-hmm. And each of these case studies could be told from the point of view of the traumatized subject. or from the point of view of the clinician, or even from that of the witness. But I think that it seems that you choose the point of view of the technology. So could you tell us more about this decision and maybe give an example or two from the book to show us how it works?
I guess I do try to flesh out the technology that is embedded in the back or in the deep context of each of those cases, right? So how technology or the technological infrastructure is kind of, you know, shapes and forms what we see in the actual practice and the unfolding of each of those either events or cases. And in that, I'm following to a certain extent some ideas that have been developed in what we would call in the more Anglo world, the German media theory. And this is following Friedrich Kittler and others. But I'm doing that only halfway, I guess, because I try to develop a kind of a critique of the non-moral stance that these the Kittler and others have taken. And I'm trying to actually take trauma as an instance or as an opportunity to rediscover morality through media. But maybe we'll talk about it more later. So a couple of examples. One example is, say, the videotaping of Holocaust survivors. And there's been a huge amount of work done on that, on how traumatic memory manifests itself despite the effort to tell a story, to tell a narrative, how it's being usually an indication of such traumatic memory would be typically silences, halts, repetitions of certain words and so forth. And I became very interested in the tools that make that available. And the tool that makes that available is videotape. Take away the videotape, you would not be able to trace, locate, rewind, replay, all those meaningful moments. They become meaningful thanks to the fact that they can be recorded and replayed. And this is something that I haven't really seen in the really, you know, general and huge discussions on media, Holocaust witnessing, also with respect to its employment in different media outlets. So it's interesting. It was interesting to me to trace back how videotape as a technology, what is special about the videotape and the videotape setting that was so innovative in the context of the Fulton of Yale archive, and how it really introduced a new dimension of how you would be able to experience and record past events, and specifically past traumatic events as associated with Holocaust and Holocaust memory.
I'll just stop you for a second to just tell us in a sentence or two about this archive and its initial mission.
Well, the initial mission of that archive that really began in the late 1970s was to record the memories of Holocaust survivors in a way that hadn't been done before. So it wouldn't be voice recorded, not handwritten, but video interviews. And that was, to us, it seems almost, you know, self-evident, but it wasn't really at that time. So the idea was to collect. First, it was around the New Haven area. Then it included other areas, other countries also. But initially, it was interviewing survivors within a time frame that around an hour and a half, 2 hours. Sometimes they were limited by the length of the video cassettes, the U-matic old video cassettes. But it was really a new format in which you would have the survivors sitting in a studio-like room at Yale University, and with some, I would say, psychoanalytic sensitivities, interview them about their memories mm-hmm. and have that on tape, mm-hmm. recorded mm-hmm. on what was then a new technology, relatively new, mm-hmm. of videotape. And that new understanding of the audiovisual testimony was evident right from the start. So they mm-hmm. wanted the initiators of that project, that's Dori Laub, and later on Jeffrey Hartman, Lauren Vlock, and others, to have a different kind of storage mm-hmm. format mm-hmm. of those of mm-hmm. those testimonies, that they would not just be just like any other historical material mm-hmm. in the library or the archive, but they would have a more of a televisual application. And mm-hmm. this is actually what they had in mind mm-hmm. at the outset, that that material could be used in education, in documentary films, and so forth. But it turns out, in hindsight, that they really produced a new kind of archive. Mm-hmm. I would mm-hmm. say they produced the infrastructure for an archive of trauma, of how mm-hmm. trauma is being related via and despite the failing of narrative. Mm-hmm. So they provided a material or source material for others to come and to explore. Mm-hmm. Later on, there were other projects, the Spielberg projects, that followed on the same or similar agenda, not necessarily the same. Nowadays, we have a different agenda of digitizing those mm-hmm. archives and having them more accessible online and so forth. But that at that time, that was really the new media. Mm-hmm. of testimony videotape. Mm-hmm.
So when you were you discussed the videotape in your book, you talk about transmission in a few senses
right.
via the videotape capabilities. Right. Can you explain a bit?
Well, we have the transmission here kind of plays on one of the main figures around the discourse of testimony and trauma, which is Shoshana Feldman. Shoshana Feldman wrote this path-breaking book, along with Dori Laub, mm-hmm. who was a psychoanalyst, psychiatrist, but also a child survivor. And then, mm-hmm. and after a few years on that project, they composed together a book called Testimony, mm-hmm. In which they each had a few chapters. And in one of the chapters, she talks about an event during a seminar that she had given, where she screened a few testimonies from the Yale archive, and following that screening, a few days after, she reports that students came in to class different, mm-hmm. as if they were re-experiencing something from the screening. Mm-hmm. Right, mm-hmm. It affected their sleeping. They were obsessed or repeatedly disgusting. Yeah. Discussing what they had seen there, and to her that was a formative moment, because she then, as she says, understood that there is something here that is very interesting, how that moment kind of transmits mm-hmm. a mm-hmm. sense of trauma that is beyond understanding, beyond a kind of, you know, more cognitive understanding. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting though that when she describes it, she puts that event on in the context of the seminar where they had read other texts, but then she, to my mind, fails to see the different media mm-hmm. that are at play. I don't think they would have those students would have reacted the same way to reading text mm-hmm. as they had with respect to watching the testimonies, the video testimonies. So a transmission moment was there, I think, from the beginning, and eventually she says in the book that was the kind of the, as she puts it, I think this is the exact quote, that moment was the germination of her work on testimony. So that moment of transmission was really what was informed her all understanding mm-hmm. without her realizing yeah. that there's media here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. At play,
which is the moment where you formalize
yeah.
your
yes, exactly. Yes, where I sneak in my home. Yeah.
So this really leads us to your argument that media technology and their logic shape the social life of trauma, both clinically and culturally. Mm-hmm. So could you expand on this? And maybe we can think about another example in the book that mm-hmm. demonstrates this.
Well, let's take an example about more on the clinical side. Mm-hmm. So when I was interested in the development of the idea, or rather the possibility of being traumatized from afar. Mm-hmm. Can you be traumatized mm-hmm. by watching something on television? And apparently now, more and more among the clinical profession, I mean, mental health professions, agree that that is possible under certain conditions. This is really unthinkable. If you'd go back 30 or 40 years ago, so what happened that this is even a possibility? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in going back to kind of a genealogical take on this, so I found an interesting episode in the history of trauma research, which is a research paradigm, later called the trauma film paradigm, mm-hmm. in which researchers, I mean, that's psychologists and psychiatrists, used films in order to measure stressful reactions. And from that, conclude what would be a kind of a stressful or traumatic reaction to actual events.
Yeah.
That was in the early 1960s. Mm-hmm. And they used, actually, one film for a decade or even more, which was self-circumcision rites in Aboriginal tribes in Australia. That was, which was produced in the 1930s. So they used the same film in groups of students and other people and their subjects, and actually measured the physical reactions, right? So heart rate, blood pressure, sweating, and so forth.
So there was explicit visuals of the of these rites.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And there was also a control group mm-hmm. who was shown a very different film, a distinctively non-traumatic film, right? So like growing crops in Iowa, or yeah, something like that. And then they, of course, compared the two groups, coming to the conclusion that they could actually find a model here to study the effects mm-hmm. of stress and trauma. They called it actually an analog. So the film is an analog to an actual, to a real event, mm-hmm. because it does produce some of the symptoms, right? Like relieving or re-experiencing some of the images. They held interviews with subjects and trying to say, well, how often did you think about the film that you saw, what kind of thoughts did you have? And from that extrapolated that you can actually learn something about the dynamics of trauma. Mm-hmm. Again, what was interesting to me here is that they had an implicit film theory here without realizing it. So the very decision, initial decision that film, or specifically a visual medium, could act as a trauma stimulus mm-hmm. Is not fully accounted for. Once you allow for that, you open the door for what would later be a kind of a visual bias of how you would understand post-traumatic memories mm-hmm. or post-trauma in general. So in the long or rather long development of how you decades be able to understand the present moment in which you would have now in the DSM, in the diagnostic manual of mental disorders, a possibility, a conditional possibility to be traumatized by the media, mm-hmm. distinctively saying this can happen only films, television, and photographs. Mm-hmm. And then there's this clause saying only if it's work-related. So it's interesting. These are all visual.
That's fascinating.
Media. So maybe there's something here that goes back to this 1960s with this paradigm that became more and more prevalent, I would mm-hmm. say, mm-hmm. among that field. So there is a kind of a media embedded in the understanding of trauma without realizing there is such.
And then you mentioned the Hillsborough tragedy, where but you can
That was probably one of the first events that people, family members, actually that saw the tragedy of being of people being really crushed by the crowd at a soccer game. So hearing about the disaster on television was absolutely devastating to them, and some actually sought legal measures afterwards, saying that, well, maybe we are entitled to some compensation because we are indirect victims of that event. And at that time, it was in the 80s, that was really rejected by the court. But now, I think such a claim, if it were to happen, has better chances because the professional claim among psychiatrists is that, well, potentially that might happen. So you would be able to make a case for it now, whether I don't think it was possible to make it now, back then, sorry.
And you actually show how following 9/11, this claim kind of got more validated.
Right.
So people that viewed the attacks on screen felt traumatized by a possibility of death, of the death of others through the distance.
Right. So the interesting thing about 9/11 is that if you look at studies that looked into the possibility of being traumatized by television, these were very few before 9/11. Mm-hmm. It was really a kind of on the margins of standard psychiatric or psychological studies. There were a few that did a study on school children after the Challenger explosion. And those demonstrated that these children exhibited some of the symptoms of post-traumatic behaviors as they were classified back then in the DSM. So it was really marginalized. But after 9/11, there's a flood. It was a flood of studies on how people watching the events on television develop symptoms that correspond with what psychiatrists and psychologists know as common to PTSD. So much so that only a few months after 9/11 was a short paper, really a call, kind of, you know, a call to arms by a dozen of psychiatrists in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is very prestigious, saying, well, we have a new situation here in which we have to take into consideration that certain television broadcasts can present an actual public health issue, right? So, and from that we start see, I could actually see more and more studies looking into media effects in sort of ways that reminded me of how scholars in media studies would do that. Like, so how often did you watch the show or the broadcast? You know, what triggered your memories and so forth. Looking into the media effects as something that might have a pathological etiology, really. So from 9/11 onwards, media broadcasting, television broadcasting, became an issue for clinical consideration, and that is the short story of that of that chapter.
Actually, I was thinking a lot about this chapter because, you know, people talk today about the onslaught of the news cycle, about the fact that we feel attacked by the news cycle, so-called in the Trump era. Do you feel that a similar claim can be made today, that we are experiencing this collective trauma of being bombarded by, you know, doom and gloom.
Right. Well, one of the things that I'm realizing now after writing the book is that you really need to think hard about what, not only what trauma is and how that kind of, you know, how the notion transforms and changes historically, but certainly when it comes to collective trauma, if such a thing even exists. I mean, mm-hmm. there are now discussions on cultural trauma, national trauma, collective trauma. I think here too, media play a key role because that what propagates those so-called traumatic images or events. I would be hesitant to say that. I think there is a growing inflation in the use of trauma, and there might, you know, we should probably be one. I would say one of the my own conclusions from this book is that is to be very careful in using the term, because it has such a cultural cachet, and nowadays and everything could be traumatic and trauma became, so you would have like trigger warnings, right? So that might kind of correlate with some kind of traumatic reaction. Some of what I was trying to do has to do with taking a more critical understanding or mm-hmm. developing more critical understanding of what trauma is and how it actually propagates.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I actually have a lot to say about trigger warnings, but we'll talk about that later. Okay. But I want to ask you a bit about the way the book is organized. And I felt that it was divided into two. So the first is really set firmly in the 20th century, and it has this narrative logic of media. And the second moves to the 21st century and to digital media. Mm-hmm. I felt that there is one chapter that bridges the two, and that is screen trauma that discusses what we just talked now about 9/11 and the possibility of being traumatized by media. Mm-hmm. So when we move to the digital part of the book, I wonder if you could compare the chapter about the Yale Project of mm-hmm. videotaping Holocaust mm-hmm. survivors that we discussed and your chapter about virtual testimony. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested both in the kind of respective arguments for both chapters, mm-hmm. okay, but also in the ways that you researched them. So did you come in with different methods or different concerns when you were thinking about these two different medias, and one kind of more analog and the other digital? Mm-hmm. So...
The main point, I guess, and you're completely right in putting the two one against the other. This was a kind of my intention, so it's good that that it resonated with you. But these are two models, really, of mm-hmm. what you might call an analog media testimony format, and the one that is digital. And in the as I said in the videotaping of testimonies, the meaningful moments were in those specific moments where someone is relating their memories, and there's a moment of silence, there's a moment of pause, of pausing, there's a moment of, like, you know, some gesture, some kind of, you know, that became very important in analyzing those narratives, because you would sit and watch the whole recording from mm-hmm. beginning to end. And in the new, I would say, in the new century and in the new understanding of testimony, an interesting project is one that is now underway at University of South California. They're doing a project called New Dimensions in Testimony, mm-hmm. which has a completely different agenda. I mean, of course, it correlates to a certain degree with the idea of, you know, preserving Holocaust memory and so forth. But the point there is how, and this is how they actually describe it, is to continue the conversation with mm-hmm. with survivors. And this is by simulating a dialogue between prospective audiences and Holocaust survivors. And the way that they did it is that they recorded really hundreds of potential answers to questions with Holocaust survivors, and they recorded them using 3D technology, so they would be able to produce from that. Yes,
no, it's insane.
Produce from those clips and recording a 3D hologram of the survivor, and the replies, the previously recorded replies, would then be processed through a designated algorithm that would find the most appropriate answer to a question presented by an audience. And they think of it really as a way that future generations could bring in their own questions, their own interests, and receive an answer as close as possible to an interaction, a live interaction. So really, what I think this project is about keeping the survivors alive, or a semblance of their presence, rather than keeping their testimony. Because this produces a completely new conception and production of testimony. It's no longer a narrative, but it's the creation of a new narrative each time anew, right? So each interaction would string together different answers. Again, going back to my interest here, it was interesting to me to see that in the new dimensions in testimony project, they were actually trying to move away from the more traditional Yale conception of testimony, get away from, or back away from, the idea of narrative as something that you would just sit back and have to kind of watch, and take on a more interactive, right, as fitting to nowadays, interactive mode of testimony, which eliminates the possibility of those pregnant moments of traumatic memory, or the ways in which traumatic memory asserts itself through those moments. So these really are completely eliminated when you construct a testimony in terms of a virtual dialogue across time. We have a different understanding of testimony in which trauma or traumatic memory does not play a role, or is not as much of a concern as it used to be.
So it's more kind of preserving the option to have a conversation with the survivor rather than to preserve their testimony in their own words and sequencing.
Exactly. And also with this comes a shift in the emphasis. So the emphasis shifts from the witness to what I call the witnessee. So it's about the recipient of witnessing, and how you would be able to present your own questions, your own interests, how the testimony would talk to you in your terms, rather than you having to put yourself in the hands or in front of the testimony and follow its sequence, its course.
So I was wondering if there's something that compromises the testimony in this method, because if I can ask the survivor, so if I'm creating the testimony with my various questions that are informed by my standpoint and my place in time, does it mean that I'm altering the testimony?
Well, I think there's no testimony as such there, not in the way that there used to be, because what is actually working in the database of that system is a collection of some 500 or 600 pre-recorded replies to various questions that were collected from various focus groups and experts, and a lot of thought went into it. So you would have a variety of answers. Now, once you present a question, the system sorts out all the available answers and locates the one that is statistically most appropriate to the parameters of the question.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is enough of a statistical connection, right, between question and answer, you would get that. So you wouldn't get a direct answer to your question, but it would be, let's say, close enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's really linking and sort of, or tailoring together different replies depending on the questions presented. There's no narrative in there, right? The narrative is created through the interaction, and it would be a different one depending mm-hmm. on the different questions.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a different conception of what testimony is altogether.
Yeah.
So it's not the narrative flow. It's not a length of experience being told through time.
Right.
But it's different segments. It's really a kind of, you know, modular memory in which you can reproduce different segments of it.
It's really interesting because it really alters the question of what it is that is preserved by this testimony.
Right. This is a very good question. Yeah.
And then this really, you know, this is one ethical question or challenge mm-hmm. that you think about in this book. And I wonder if we can maybe get into another example of these ethical uneases mm-hmm. or challenges that you write about, maybe through the question of virtual therapy.
Right.
Maybe you can explain more about that.
So this is another project that is developed at the University of South California. Mm-hmm. And if what we just talked about is virtual testimony, this mm-hmm. is virtual therapy. Mm-hmm. So these are two, like, the two big discourses, I guess, from across the book. And this program suggests that it's possible to treat post-trauma, PTSD symptoms,
mm-hmm.
by means of exposing patients to experiences similar to those that created their own traumatic reactions using virtual reality
mm-hmm.
scenarios. Basically, these scenarios are basically videotape game scenarios or mm-hmm. combat scenarios, like, you know, riding a Humvee or going through a marketplace in some mid-eastern town.
Mm-hmm.
And these are pretty much generic scenarios, and drawing on a method called exposure therapy, which stipulates that in order to treat traumatic symptoms or post-trauma more generally, it's not enough to talk about it. So talk therapy as though cannot get deep enough into the brain areas, what they call a fear structure, that
mm-hmm.
that affects or is affected by the trauma. What needs to be done is you have to retrain those brain circuits
mm-hmm.
so they would react appropriately and not overreact. So in this virtual reality therapy, they would bring typically veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan and put them into scenarios close to those that they had experienced and run them through a series of treatment of mm-hmm. of several weeks or so, by the end of which, so it is claimed, they would be pretty much cured. Interestingly, one of the selling points of this project is that you don't have to talk about your mother, right? So it's a non-psychoanalytic way of dealing with it. It's not about talking. It's not about narrative. It's not mm-hmm. about discourse. It's about really getting into a virtual world and through it evoking those areas. And it's typically the more primitive, quote-unquote, areas in the brain, the limbic system, that would react to threat and mm-hmm. danger, and you would retrain them to react appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
This presents some interesting moral questions. For instance, okay, so let's say, I'm not saying, but let's say that works. Let's say they're right. So what does it mean that you would now be able to have soldiers coming back, right, from the front line and processing them through those programs in which they would be de-traumatized, right? So not that I'm, of course, advocating that people should be traumatized or that there's something positive about being traumatized, but once you eliminate that, once the army government puts a lot of money into such a program that really finds a way to deal with trauma efficiently, you really rob the, or you really kind of, you know, deactivate some moral agency from those who are affected by trauma. For all the pain that it causes, trauma has a moral, or opens up a moral possibility in the sense of being vulnerable and being exposed and realizing the possibility of being exposed to threat and danger. Once you have that, and now there's even a program that puts soldiers before being deployed into such a treatment as though preventing trauma to develop to begin with, or from the outset.
Preemptive
treatment, right? A kind of, you know, immunization of trauma. Mm-hmm. So what kind of a soldier would be one that cannot be traumatized? I think this is a very important political and moral question. Right. A soldier that you could actually develop in a soldier possibility of not being traumatized. Mm-hmm. That's a real question.
Yeah, and what happens to empathy?
What happens to empathy? What happens to moral agency? What happens to responsibility in such a case?
Yeah, no, that was really a fascinating project, and it really opens up a lot of questions. So as we're kind of winding down this interview, I wanted to ask you if there was anything in the research process that surprised you, something that you felt that you learned and you didn't expect to think about in the way that you think about it now.
Well, really, in each of the cases, I found I was surprised in one way or the other. I mean, I knew that I had an intuition in each of them that there's something going on here, but I'm not quite sure what it is. I'm yet to know what's going to happen here. I had an idea, but I can think of instances in each and every one of them that I realized something. For instance, the film paradigm that I mentioned. This was something that I only found out after I started the research, and it really kind of surprised me. I said, "How is that possible? And how is it possible that I haven't heard about it before?" Right. So that was one of those things, and there were others, I guess, to a certain extent. That's a good measurement of if you're on the right track, if your research is capable of surprising you.
Okay, so fantastic. I guess we'll finish at this moment of surprise and insight. And I want to thank you again for this interview and for your book.
Thank you so much.